Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we've got Eugene Johnson. Eugene is the founder and CEO at Revy. Eugene, welcome to the podcast.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
Excited to have you here. So let's start with Revy. What problem is it solving in the marketplace?
So basically, Revy is what I would consider like a next-gen transactional tool. So, you know, you have your traditional in-person physical POSs, you know, the Squares, the Clovers, and the, you know, Toast of the world. And then you've got your digital transactions, your DoorDash, your Uber Eats, and, you know, things of that nature. What Revy is a bridge between those two worlds. You know, e-commerce has kind of shifted how consumers engage in the digital world. But when you go into the physical world, it's still very analog. So what Revy does is it takes a POS style system, but treats it like an e-commerce process where the focus is not just facilitating a transaction or operational excellence. It's about gathering data, you know, converting consumers at the point of sale, name, phone number, email preferences, things of that nature, and then leveraging that data to drive more revenue back into the business. And as you engage with those consumers, you create a marketplace and basically, you know, impact the consumers in ways that would digitize their physical world environment, like, you know, simplifying why, when, you know, how you make a purchase when you walk into a store. Why do you need to pull out your credit card? You know, when I'm walking in a Macy's, why do I have to, you know, look through the shelves? Like, there's a multitude of ways to digitize the physical world experience. And once you have that identity of that consumer, you can create a ton of different experiences. So that's essentially what Revy does.
Wow. So how long ago did you start the company, and what's the evolution look like since inception?
Yeah, we started in 2019, January of 2019. We grew about 50% a month, every single month from January of 2019 all the way up to March of 2020. Yeah, I don't have to tell you what happened in March of 2020. But essentially, we dropped like 90% almost overnight. And then pulled ourselves out. It took us about a year and a half, 2 years, pulled ourselves out. And, you know, now we've got, you know, thousands of businesses on our platform, you know, millions of consumers on our platform. And it's, you know, been a fun run, but definitely has its ups and downs, and we, you know, rode those downs, learned from them to get better at the ups.
So pandemic hits, you wake up and you realize that you've got a fire on your hands. What was your thinking at the time? Was it clear that no matter what you were going to power ahead, or did you have a framework that you used to decide whether or not you were going to move on to the next thing?
Yeah. So, you know, when you, you know, funny enough, one of my mentors, his name was Paul J. Meyer, was my first mentor. He was a billionaire. Crazy how I met him, but I met him when I was 18. And I remember when I was talking to him, he used to always say, great entrepreneurs know how to turn an L into a V. And I didn't know what he meant until this moment. Like, I always thought he was talking about a loss into a victory. But when I saw my chart go like this and go like this, and then tail off like this, and then come back up, I understood what he meant. And so essentially, I had the viewpoint that we were going to find a way. The question just became what the way was. And so we did everything from, you know, we had self-service kiosks, which was one of our main, you know, products at the time. You know, we were sending people sanitation kits. We were building new products that would be more digital. Like, we, you know, we did everything we could. We tried to convince business owners how to reshape their business, you know, putting kiosks outside of the stores, putting tables in front of the doors so that, you know, they could have that interaction and still make purchases. You know, we did what we could to try to combat that. But I think for our focus, we knew that if there's a will, there's always a way. And so we knew we were going to figure out the way. The question was, what was it?
What's the expression? You know, it's not about falling down, it's about learning to pick ourselves back up.
100%.
So love it. Why you what you said is it's Paul Meyer.
Yeah, Paul, yep.
Curious, did you was it an did you always seek out mentors in your career
No,
or
no. I grew up in a pretty rough neighborhood in New York City. And prior to meeting Paul, I was a pretty troubled kid.
okay.
And a friend of mine's dragged me to a conference in Oklahoma City, a leadership conference. And I was like, 18. Everybody there was, most of the people there were like in their 50s, 60s, 70s. And there was a party. And I sat outside of the party and got a chance to meet this guy, Paul, 85. Not really like a big personality, but mostly asked me questions about like who I am and what I want to do, existential life questions. And I got a chance to learn from somebody that just from a happenstance of an interaction, and that became the guy that I followed and tried to learn from and tried to emulate in the early days. So yeah, I wasn't a mentor seeker until after that moment.
Well, I'm really happy for you that it worked out. It is mentors are seem to be a reoccurring theme on the podcast, and the general consensus is they're great. But for whatever the reason is, maybe it's just the people I'm talking to, but as a society, we don't seek them out.
Yeah.
And tremendous amount of wealth of knowledge there. And so yeah, I mean, if there's a reoccurring theme here is mentors at any stage,
100%.
18 or now, are great. Well, that's fantastic. All right, so you power through the pandemic, and now it sounds like you've got call it 3.5, 4 years of post-pandemic activity.
Yeah.
How have you had any other pivots? Are there any other significant moments on the trajectory that you've had to deal with, or the way the business has evolved?
Yeah, I would say the most significant moment is really the moment that we're living in right now. So it really started in January of this year. So
Okay.
I, in the early days, so this is my fourth business. My first company was a reseller business. We built that to over 800 sales and marketers across the country. Then I had a brand business, an investment company, and then this company. And in my investment company, a friend of mine had called me. This was in early 2013, and he said, "Eugene, hey, have you heard of this thing called blockchain?" And I said, "Oh, no, I never heard of it. What is it?" And he starts walking me through crypto, and I just catch a fire for what the story behind what crypto was trying to accomplish. And so I became an investor. So my average Bitcoin price was like $200 a coin.
Wow.
And at that time, I was the most liquid that I had ever been. I had the most conviction that I ever had, but my investment didn't match the liquidity and the commitment. So, don't cry me a river. I made a lot of money, but not, it should have been enough that I'd be on an island somewhere. And I told myself I would never make that mistake again. And come January of this year, I start using AI in a way that really started to change my perspective. And I remember prior to that, I was using AI. You would use something like ChatGPT or any of the other tools. They had like, social media tools that do clippings, and they had design tools and all these different tools, but they were okay. And just something happened in January where I started using it, and things that would have taken me 3 hours or 3 days, I was doing in minutes or hours. And it really shifted my perspective. And I said, "Oh man, this is that Bitcoin moment that I am in right now." And so I shifted our entire team to become AI native as the primary focus, not just in the product, but in our product, in our operations, in our viewpoints, and we had to define like what is AI native and what is AI adjacent. Because there's a lot of companies that are saying, "Oh, we're AI, or we leverage AI," but they're really just AI adjacent. And we said we didn't we wanted to run. We wanted to be powered by AI. And the way to answer that question, whether you're AI native or AI adjacent, is really simple. If the LLMs, all of the LLMs on the planet disappeared, would your company, would your department, would your role continue as, as if nothing happened? Or would it diminish? Would it demolish and you couldn't keep going? If it would diminish or demolished, you actually are AI native. If you could just keep running as, as normal and all the LLMs are gone, then you're just AI adjacent. And I said to myself that we would make sure that every department, every person, the entire company, our entire product became an AI native product, because I believe that those who are AI native are going to zoom past most of companies in the market. And I really think startups are in for a rude awakening, because I actually think that startups are going to have a very, very hard life ahead in the next 24 to 36 months.
Well, so it's interesting the parallels to Bitcoin. I mean, so I 100% agree that being an early adopter on the right technology has the potential to provide a material competitive advantage. The idea of holding, in this case, just fully embracing what you're doing. I mean, it makes great sense. I love the idea of create a mandate, maybe not the right word, but guiding the company towards the idea that this is an extremely powerful tool and we will all benefit through its adoption, I think is great. I'm curious. So, CEO to CEO, I share your philosophy, and your assessment. So we're doing professional services that run the gamut between accounting and finance, human resources, recruiting, go to market. And across there, we're finding tremendous opportunity to streamline workflows. And my sense is that it is here to stay. So what's your take? How does this change your human capital strategy? Do you have what's your opinion? Do you think it's going to or what impact do you think the technology will have on your hiring?
Well, it's impact on everything. I think it goes even beyond a technology that's here to stay. Like, I feel like we've entered an era where AI native product velocity and mass distribution is going to decide everything. Like, AI native creation and mass distribution aren't just like advantages that we'll be able to take advantage of. They are the dividing line between those who rise and those who vanish. And the reason why I believe that is, what is the value of a small business or a startup? You have the ability to be niche. You have the ability to move quickly. You have the ability to iterate in ways that big companies can't. What happens when a big company becomes as fast, as nimble, as clear of execution? I'll give you an example. In our company, Grubhub decided when we early in the in maybe like 2021, 2022, Grubhub decided to create a competing product, a kiosk. Now, that creating a hardware in the physical world is extremely difficult. A lot of people think it's like super easy because, oh, it's just, simple functions, simple flows. But, it is extremely hard. Grubhub put $1 billion into that flow and then killed it 18 months later. The question becomes why? Because it's hard. And what does AI do? Make some things that are hard a lot easier, and allows for you to, if they had the ability to only spend $50 million instead of $1 billion, I would still be fighting Grubhub today. And that's what a lot of these bigger companies will have the ability to do. If they shift their environment, now most big companies are not going to be able to do this, and they're going to disappear. And some of the newer AI going from 0 to $100 million in ARR in 12 months, which is, honestly, it's just ridiculous. But those companies will become the established companies of the future, or the business, big businesses who have made that shift. And for the big businesses who have made that shift, imagine competing against a company that is doing exactly what you're doing with probably more intelligent people, more experienced people, and more money to throw at that particular problem. it becomes hard for startups to fight that. So I think that over the next 36 months, you have the most important opportunity really in business history to either establish yourself as the runner or get swallowed by the wave that I think it is, that I think is coming and is already shaping itself now. So, I actually think entrepreneurs have a real strong opportunity here, and it will affect your hiring, it will affect your team building, it will affect your vision casting, it will affect how you set goals, it will affect how fast you hit those goals. It'll affect there's not a piece of the business that this thing won't impact. And as a person who is not just dealing with it internally and building those structures internally and seeing, I'll give you one last example. We started building product for a competitor company. So we had a competitor, they just raised $100 million. I won't say their name, but they just raised $100 million. They had about six main products. We already had two of the six. I was trying to get my product team to understand what it meant to be AI native. And so they weren't getting it. So I said, you know what? I told my assistant, I said, clear my schedule for the week. And I'm going to go build stuff myself and show what's possible. And I built their entire platform myself in 24 hours, the entire prototype of that platform, and then passed it to engineers to start the process of developing it. We just released that product this past week. The company that we're competing against, they charge $500 a month for that product because that's where they make their money as SaaS. We are actually an infrastructure product. So I don't really care whether we make any money from the product itself, the software. So I'm going to pump that entire market and throw a ton of money behind it at no cost. I'm literally going to make that product free. I am not a big star. I'm not like, I'm not Netflix, right? But I'm going to impact that startup very drastically because of the level of product I'm putting in the market. Imagine when Microsoft or Facebook or whoever decides to do that. It's going to be a problem.
It is. And well, since so I have a bunch of different thoughts. One, if there's consensus that product market fit is the holy grail, I think the challenge that the world is going to face is that it's no longer, once you reach it's no longer static. You're going to have to continue to iterate because the cost to compete is, I mean, AI is just deflationary. There's no escaping it. Your example is great. Two, it begs the question, and I find myself in this conversation a lot. It's like, well, why aren't the incumbents going to win? And that's a fair question. And so my thought goes to, well, what competitive advantages then do early stage companies possess? And it's interesting, you didn't say it explicitly, but I heard it as I'm listening to you, and it's the ability to take risk. Because I don't think there's any two ways about it. Bureaucracy is real. It exists. It for as amazing as Google is, it exists there too. It's part of the human condition. And so, I would encourage any founder to, borrow a page from your playbook, learn a technology, leverage it in the business, and then take risk.
I would say bureaucracy is real because, funny enough, Google had the technology OpenAI had long before OpenAI had it. So, but it was bureaucracy that stopped that technology from coming out.
That's
So, like, the reality is, big companies, the biggest problem is protecting the profit margins or the shareholder voice. Those companies are either going to say, I don't care if I don't know if you remember old school Jeff Bezos and talking to his shareholders and saying, look, we're not going to be profitable, we're not going to be optimizing for profit, we're going to reinvest. And if you don't like it, sell the stock. If you don't have that type of mentality to say, we're going to go down this direction, it's going to shake things up. We may lose money in certain areas doing this, but we're going in this direction. If you don't do that, the likelihood is you probably won't turn fast enough. Because I really do think that we've got about 24 to 36 months before that door closes. But I just to set double tap on something you said product market fit. I think that that entire conversation will be destroyed. Every investor I've ever talked to since the time I started in investments has talked about, like, do you have the product market fit? Do you have differentiation? Like, how can you gain differentiation when a person can create your same product in 24 hours? That thing is going to be demolished, and the new thing is going to take its place.
No, I agree with your assessment. I think it's spot on. It's gonna redefine how we think about founders. I think it'll place a really bigger emphasis on, yes, having a technical background will remain extremely beneficial. I think the numbers prove that out. You're seeing a lot more PhDs. You're seeing a lot more older founders. At least this is what's coming out of Carta in terms of where they're seeing investment dollars flow. But you're right. I mean, you're gonna have to be malleable. If you got a too rigid view of the world, I think it's gonna act as a headwind. So, all right. If we could take a step back from, I got a bunch more questions on Revy, but you mentioned you're a serial entrepreneur and this isn't your first rodeo. I would love to hear a little bit more about key lessons learned over the years and how they inform how you run Revy today.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I had to learn, and this is what Paul used to say all of the time. He used to say, Eugene, if you can change the way you think, you can change your life. And I didn't realize at the time that my thinking was a little stinky. And I had to reevaluate what my philosophies were around certain indications. And as a founder, you step into this business and you think that success is doing everything. And then you learn that you have, it's almost like you get drowned by the noise, right? You've got metrics, you've got emotions, you've got Slack notifications and emails and investors and Twitter profits and all of these things that you're trying to like clear your head to see clear. And I think one of the biggest pieces of the puzzle is like learning to separate the signal from the noise. And the noise is unsolicited status updates and half-formed ideas and decisions that you don't necessarily need to make. You should be, empowering other people to make, and issues without, people bringing issues without actually like recommendations on how to solve those issues. Like, these are the things that create noise for founders. And the signal is like, how do we get clear decision making, that we can pressure test? How do we get how do we understand the material risk and trade-offs of the business? How do we focus on revenue generation? How do we hire at the best way possible? Like, these are the things that a lot of founders don't understand, but I had to like learn the hard way of just like bumping my head constantly trying to figure out like what are the things that are important. One of the lessons that I had to learn and really still learning is how important the right hires are. If I were to start over, that those first 5, 10 people that I brought into the company, I would spend more and hire less versus hiring more and spending less per person. So if I had a $1 million budget, instead of trying to hire 10 people who can I can pay 100,000, I'd hire four that I pay 250K to. And that one shift, I think, would have changed a lot, because there's things that you know, and there's things that you're guessing, and there's things that you learned that you're hoping to apply. And that stack, the value of the information on those stacks are super important. And most people, when you pump out information, you got to ask yourself, are we guessing? Is this a thesis? Or, how close to assurance do I have in that information? And when you've got a bunch of people guessing across the entire organization, it does cause a bit of chaos, and you do a lot of learning by trial and error. And that's fine for an 18-year-old kid in your basement, but if you're trying to build a $1 billion company, doing learning everything through trial and error is not the right way. Oh, it's not the most efficient way to grow a business. So these are some of the things that I've kind of picked up over time, understanding the difference between motion and progress, right? Like, what's just us being AI? I used to always say to my leadership team, let's not be an octopus on roller skates. A whole lot of activity, but we're not actually going anywhere. Like, what's the difference between motion and progress? So I think these are some of the things I kind of picked up along the way.
I like that. I may borrow that. Difference between motion and progress. What are some of the things you do to eliminate distractions?
I mean, one, I turn off, all notifications. I don't have any notifications. I go to my email last, not first in the day. I may jump into my email at noon, one, after I've already touched all of the things that I'm supposed to do. I always start my day with a plan. So I'm very clear on exactly, like, I've already. Today has already been done yesterday. I'm just living it out right now. And I think that that's something that a lot of people miss. They come into the day and they're like, okay, what's important today? But like, as a founder, you've already got to be aligned to like, how am I going to make this day great? One of the things is like goal setting. I have this concept that I learned from Paul called 51 amp or 51 amps, I should say. And it's basically like a 5-year vision, 1 year execution. Like, what is the one, two, or three things you can do this year that can get you closer to that 5-year vision? And then AM is achievable milestones. Like, have you broken this thing down? Like, I know what I'm going to do this quarter. I know what I'm going to do this month. This month, if I do these things this month, it will lead me to the quarter goal. If I do these things this week, it will lead me to the week goal. If I do these things today, it will lead me to the month ago. So like that type of mentality has been strong. And then P is purpose and S is systems. So it's not good enough to actually have goals. You need to have systems that help build on top that drive those specific goals. So these are kind of some of the things that I think time blocking is super important, making sure that you have the right times to do certain things. These are how I kind of like you kill the noise.
Love it. You also mentioned hiring, the value of having smart and effective staff. So how does that translate into culture? And how do you think about managing people?
Yeah, I think as our company has grown, we've got over 70 employees now. And so now there's certain things that you learn that you're realizing, oh, I just had this conversation yesterday. I'm like, oh, certain cultural elements are slipping. And I'm like, we're trying to pinpoint how and where. And a lot of it roots back to the hiring process and how you do it. And I remember I was in a leadership conference for a Series B investor had a leadership conference, and I was in a conference, and one of the leaders on stage said, "Raise your hand if you think recruiting is the number is the top five things that you should be focused on as a CEO of the company." Everybody 100% raised their hands. Raise your hand if you think it's top three. 100%. Raise your hand if you think it's number one. 100%. Everybody said, like, if you're going to be successful, recruiting is the number one thing. Hiring is the number one thing. Then he asked a simple question. How much have you invested in learning how to recruit great? Raise your hand if you've invested more than any other thing as the number one thing. Nobody raised their hand. And I'm just like, why? It just opened my eyes to the fact that, man, we know that it's the most important thing, but we very rarely invest in it. And it's the thing that sets the culture.
Yeah, it's interesting. So my sense, well, there's no reason why people shouldn't be exploring for tools. I recently met a founder. This is actually really interesting. They're using AI to assess candidates by having them do a 15 to 30 minute dialogue about themselves and then running, scripts against it to anticipate behavior. Efficacy aside, to your point, there are tools out there
Yep.
that can increase the odds that you find someone who has the potential to be a great employee.
Yeah.
Why more people don't do it, I don't know. It's a good question. You're right. I mean, I would say generally it's everyone, you'd get a lot of consensus in the top three.
Yep.
So you hire someone, you figure out they're not, for whatever the reason, it's not a fit. How much leeway do you give them? Do you try to find a different role, or do you find that you're quick to fire?
So in leadership roles, I'm always quick to fire. For others, I've been a bit slow, to be honest. And it's probably my worst feature as a leader is like I care a lot about people. And so I tend to give people more chances than they probably deserve. But the reality is, I think if you ask me what the core of my philosophy is, it's hire fast, fire fast. You're never going to get perfect on the person that you hire. So you have to be very clear on what you want and try to get as close to that as possible. And then in your first 30, 60, 90 days, you probably know. Your first 30 days, you probably know. And now you're saying, okay, am I helping guide this person up? And if they can't really make it to where we need them to go, how quickly am I guiding them out? You know, I've hired a VP and let them go within 90 days. You know, so I think that every great founder has to be willing to cut the cord. And this is probably the thing that holds, most companies back, is having too many B and C players.
I agree. So, looking ahead, so it sounds like business is firing on all cylinders, but as you mentioned, the world is going to change in the coming years. So, what's your outlook? And anything that you can share for proactive steps you're taking to make sure you remain in front of the curve?
Yeah, I mean, so I have a big goal for 2026. You know, our goal is $1 billion in transactions in 2026 alone. And so, but everybody has a vision, very few operationalize it, right? Like, we want to change the world, but you got to turn that into weekly priorities, org designs, incentives, KPIs, so on and so forth. And so I think that that's really what I care about the most right now, is like, how do I set up our team for success? And how do I create a way for my executives to lead at the level that I would lead at? And some of it means like slightly supporting the executive, and some of it means like finding the right person for the next, success. You know, what got me here is not going to get me there. And so, like, thinking about those things, I think is probably primary focus for the next year. But I think it's about strong vision, organizing that vision, strong leadership, organizing those leaders, strong hiring, strong culture, and really just keeping money in the bank. So, I think that those are kind of the things that are top of mind for me.
Great. I love it. I also, I realize I want to give a shout out to Jonathan Lowenauer for introducing us. Enjoy the work. We've had Jonathan on the podcast before, so shout out to Jonathan for making the connection. On that note, how do you think about your own, taking care of yourself, making
Yeah.
sure that, in the process of, building a company that's going to It's, I'm sure I get the sense you're going to do a billion in transactions next year. How do you make sure that you're still in a position to be able to show up day in, day out and take care of business?
Yeah, a lot. As I have grown, I've started to realize, I've built businesses into the hundreds of employees, but I've never built businesses into the thousands. And I don't even know if we'll ever do that in today's world, but I think that the function of the type of leader you need to be to build a company into the thousands will still stay, even if the company never reaches the thousands. And that's the question that I'm asking myself every day. Am I the leader that can take us from a billion to 100 billion? And over the last year and over the next year, that's the biggest thing I'm focusing on. Can I be healthy mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally? Like, how do I get my mind to a place where I am successful, not just in executing the day-to-days, but thinking? And that process is an intentional process. So I'm seeking guidance around. I've got, two advisors hoping to bring on a third in the beginning of the new year. I've got, processes that I'm putting in place as far as my learning schedules and, what I feel like I need to know this year, the books I'm reading, the audios I'm listening to, the events that I'm going to. Like, these are the things that I need to do to keep myself calibrated mentally, because, at the end of the day, if you are a great founder, without you, that company doesn't run. And what I am trying to do is say, like, how do I bring the best of me to the rest of the organization? And that's something that seems It sounds easy in communication, but it's a lot harder in reality.
Not often I've had guests state that spirituality is important to them. If you're amenable to sharing, I totally understand if you're not, but I'd love to know, what you do to make sure that there's alignment with the soul.
Funny enough, I am, people don't know, not everybody knows this, but I'm a CEO and I'm a pastor. So I operate on both spectrums, and so it's a part of my everyday life. And so because it's a part of my everyday, I had a big decision to make when I started business, which was, do I be the Eugene, the business guy, and then keep my spiritual side as a side thing that I am only when I'm outside of the business world. But the reality is, I needed to be true to myself and be one person. And that just means that I bring everything. That doesn't mean like I'm not having Bible studies on a Monday morning, but what it does mean is that all of my values, all the things I care about, they still are persistent in who I am and how I operate the business. And I think that that's the most important thing. And if you stay grounded there, I think the hardest thing to do is not be grounded there and be successful in business, because business will throw you off. Success will throw you off mentally, because I know a lot of people who have been very successful and are miserable. Because you got to understand the difference between success and fulfillment. Success is about achieving a goal. Fulfillment is about achieving what the purpose is inside. And if you don't get locked in on fulfillment, you can start floating. Mentally, emotionally, within your family, things of that nature. So, everybody needs an anchor, and mine happens to be, my relationship with Christ. But that, I think, is the most important piece.
I love it. That's brilliant. Kudos to you. I think you have the distinction of being the first, but definitely the first pastor, I think first pastor we've had on, but first person to articulate it the way you did. So I love it. Unfortunately, I see we're near the end of our time here. Before we wrap up, as you reflect back over the decades, just what key lessons have bubbled up, or is there anything in particular that you wish you would have knew when you first started out?
Yeah, your job as a CEO, as a founder, is to train emotional control under pressure. Most founders and CEOs are on an emotional roller coaster. Things are great, everybody's happy. When things are bad, everybody's sad. Like, you've got to have an even keel, and you have to learn how to not spiral with the numbers when the numbers dip, because they will. Like, things go down, things go up. You need to learn how to not lie to yourself. Tell yourself the truth. If things are good, one of my mentors used to always say, you can't grow from where you are, where you think you are. You can only grow from where you actually are. You just gotta learn how to absorb fear without like letting it leak downstream. Like, most people's fear, your confidence, how you show up impacts those around you. And if you can show up with power and authority, most people around you will show up with power, authority, faith, belief, and you start moving mountains.
Leadership is real. And it's interesting, it is, this is a favorite subject of mine and my brother-in-law, but we often talk about, how do you nurture resilience? And actually, we found a really practical way: cold plunges. Everyone I know who's incorporated into their lifestyle, they talk about the health benefits, but we've also just talked about the emotional discipline that it's yielded, because everyone says the same thing. Even after years, nobody wants to get in. And once you do, and you can stay in there for a bit, you realize that a lot of the other things that we encounter throughout the day pale in comparison with subjecting yourself to 40 degree water. I know we talked about Paul, but anyone else in your life over the years you'd like to recognize, either personally or professionally, of having a meaningful impact on you?
I would say two people. I would say my wife, mostly because of her increasing my standards. There's a book called The Science of Scaling, and it's talking about it's easier to grow 10x than it is 2x. And my wife is always a 10x thinker. So, I'm talking about 100 million, she's talking about a billion. I'm talking about a billion, she's talking about 10. And she always stretches me down to that place. And then I would say my mom is the one who taught me resilience. She's the one who taught me how to stand when the whole world has thrown, boulders and knives and all types of weaponry at you. So yeah, I think those are the two people I would give a shout out to. They help me mentally more than they even know.
Fantastic. I love it. Eugene, really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your perspective. This was an awesome episode. Really excited for you. If there's
Thanks.
anyone in the audience who wants to, learn more about Revy or just get in touch with you, how can they find you?
I'm mostly on Instagram. So Eugene K Johnson, Eugene K Johnson, and send me a DM and I'll get back to you.
Fantastic. I love it. Again, for the benefit of our audience, Eugene Johnson, founder and CEO of Revy. Eugene, thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you for signing.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.